Well, I was just saying the rose hasn't really fulfilled its purpose until it gets plucked. And I guess that's what... Spoilers. She's the rose that gets plucked.
Coping mechanisms through stories. Foreshadowing with roses.
Welcome back to the show. I'm here with Lydia Malcolm.
And I'm here with Naomi McQuaid. And I don't think that we had told them what movie we were going to be doing this time, right?
Uh-oh, you guys are in for it, except that you've already clicked on the link.
So you probably know what we're doing. So, yeah.
Which is fine. We're going to talk about Pan's Labyrinth.
I'm going to butcher this. Guillermo del Toro?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe not with that cadence, but totally Guillermo. Dang it. Moving on.
Selena Gomez.
Okay, 2006, Pan's Labyrinth.
We're still trying to figure out the format of what we're going to do, because we had first, on Batman Returns, we had talked about what brought us to the movie and what like initially interested us. But I don't know, do you want to go ahead and try that for this one?
Well, I think I know that it certainly looks like the kind of film I like. It's dark and it's fantastic in the truest sense of the word. There's an element of fantasy and an element of darkness. I certainly thought that it was going to be more child-friendly, like the peoples of Spain who were unaware of the dark notes this film hits pretty unashamedly.
Yeah, I wasn't entirely shocked by the darker elements. I think I was more like taken back by the fact that that it was really bloody.
Oh, this is not the animal I thought I'd be pulling out of this box.
Right. So, but yeah, it was something that definitely drew me because this is my kind of film. I think this was coming out in a time where I was like a little bit more open to foreign films. I'm not going to lie. I had seen some foreign films before this and I was always just sort of like bored. Mm. And I don't know why. I always loved anime growing up. But anime is a completely different beast than some of the other foreign films that can come out.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the subtitled things that I've encountered, it's been largely anime, but I've been to a handful of film festivals and you kind of get drawn into a lot of foreign films in that setting. And I think the thing that strikes me most about live action subtitled films is certainly because it's almost always set outside of the United States, there's, I think, the cultural relevance changes. And so the emphasis on the human interaction or the whatever interaction changes drastically. So the point where I would be taken aback is as a cis white female middle-aged United States citizen, it's going to be different than what hits, you know, Maria in Spain in 2006. So I think that it's hard to keep that in your mind as you're watching the rise and fall of the drama. What I did note, and it was going to be a very dramatic moment later on in the podcast, what I was going to say was sometimes during a subtitled film, I will zone out because I'm a little ADD, just tiny bit ADD. And so I'll stop reading for a little while and the dialogue will just go away for me. And I've only got the visuals and the tone of the person speaking. And it takes on a whole different flavor. I don't know. It's like eating the broth of the soup, but none of the chunks in it. It gives you a different sense of the dish.
So there's this thing where your brain can only process one thing at a time. Like if you are hearing someone speak words and you're trying to read text scrolling on the screen, your brain is only going to focus on one or the other. And this is part of the reason why people who like dubbing of anything foreign have kind of a valid point. Your brain isn't going to be able to process the visual aspects of the film while you're trying to also process the visual text at the bottom of the screen. So, I mean, I prefer subtitles. I just feel like sometimes the original actors can just kind of bring that performance out just a little bit better than some voice actors in America. But that's just my personal preference. So yeah, I totally understand why you would want to zone out and it giving that different aspect. Because it's one thing to go ahead and have to read the text so you're understanding the reasons, the dialogue, which is important, versus just being able to take the film at face value and trying to pick up the emotions that are getting emoted, because that's kind of what acting does. It's about emoting.
Yeah. And Guillermo really, from what I've read, wanted to keep it as like Spanish as possible. Like,
right.
I mean, world-renowned director, writer, he puts in years of work into his scripts and the visuals that he's planning out. I mean, he started writing this in 93. So, I mean, the fact that it was published more than a decade later really speaks, I think, to how dedicated he is to his craft. So when we go through this, we'll just have the assumption of goodwill all around us for not stepping on Spanish culture. There's a possibility we could misunderstand or misinterpret a character or a portion of the plot just because we tend to take things as one artistic piece and not put in the, you know, years and years of study it would take to fully comprehend from the director's perspective.
Right. If any Spanish listeners are out there who know certain aspects of this movie and you would like to let us know, please let us know in a very polite manner. Because again, like I don't mind.
You'd be polite when you complain at me, Lydia Malcolm.
I'm just saying, as Americans, we're kind of ingrained to not worry about what foreigners think of us.
Oh, no.
I know. Okay.
I worry. I do. I'm okay.
Thank you, Dan Harmon, for making that line, because I just relate to it so much.
What, that was a quote?
That was from Community. Like what was it? Yvette Nicole Brown's character, Shirley.
Shirley.
Okay. She was like, Jeff, it was the first Community episode I ever saw. And this is part of the reason why I watch Community. Because she was like, Jeff, you don't have to worry about what foreigners think of you. That's your birthright as an American.
Oh, no. That's exactly her character.
but it's kind of, it's an aspect of American culture. We don't really get to see what happens in other countries. So if you feel like yelling at anyone on this podcast, feel free to, you know, yell at me. I don't know.
You got a thicker skin than I do. Don't yell at me. Just know that I just don't know a lot about Spain in 1944.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So with all that said, and with those kind of disclaimers.
With Jonathan's thoughtful editing so that we sound way smarter than.
And nicer.
Yeah.
I just feel like that whole like thing I just said was just like, Lydia, you've just been.
That's okay. You're in a safe place with an editor. Before it goes out into the world.
I do thank you, Jonathan, for being so nice. I mean, you don't have to be when it comes to me, so.
You're responsible to make me look and sound good at all times.
I just want to sound nice. I don't care if I sound smart. I just want to sound nice. I am such a Hufflepuff.
Like me too!
Every time I take the Pottermore quiz, I turn out to be a Ravenclaw, and I'm always just a little bit saddened because I want to be a Hufflepuff so bad.
I just Hufflepuff so hard they think I'm a Gryffindor. Okay. Shall we dip our toe into the pool that is Pan's Labyrinth?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's start. Okay, so the very first scene is the very first shot of the very first scene. It's kind of spoilerish territory.
I mean, we certainly start at the ending, mm-hmm. at the beginning, but it's a black screen and all you hear is panting and singing, and it's very disturbing to me.
Right. And then you see this little girl bleeding.
In reverse.
Like Memento. And then it kind of like pans away from her as the blood is going back into her nose. And we hear a fairy tale about a princess. A princess whose father is king of the underworld. And she escapes her life.
Because she was being oppressed.
Well, that was kind of the feeling. But, I mean, she was willing to go back, so it couldn't have been too bad.
Well, the narration, which I believe was the Pan character.
Doug Jones.
Not Doug Jones.
It wasn't?
No, because all of Doug Jones plays the Pan in this film, physically, but mm-hmm. all of his auditory was replaced by a Spanish actor.
Oh, okay. I see.
So the narration says, she was being oppressed and to escape, she ran away, and the hope was that she'd return later and reclaim her throne.
Yeah. And that she would come back home in another, or she would find life in another body in our world.
Oh.
I think that's how it ended. And then we see the main character, Ophelia. She's traveling in a car, and she's, you know, reading a book, I believe. And you see her mother, a woman standing next to her. We find out it's her mother. Her mother's pregnant.
And super sick. Handkerchief to mouth sick.
Yeah. To the point where while they're traveling, she asks Ophelia to have the driver stop the car so she can get out and, you know, maybe vomit or, you know, just she needs a moment of rest. And of course, before they stop, you know, her mother's just like, oh, your head's such in fairy tales and your head's up in the clouds and you love these books. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, stop living in fictional worlds.
Well, she seems okay with it. It doesn't become an issue till later on. She's like, you just brought so many books. And I'm like, yeah. And
What else are you going to do in 1944?
You're going outside. There are trees there and squirrels.
Twitter hasn't been invented. YouTube hasn't been invented. This little girl can't create her own podcast.
There are no other children. What is she going to do? Mm-hmm. I'd bring me a book, too.
Yeah. And so while they get out of the car, Ophelia starts looking around the forest. It's kind of like gives this feeling of it being like magical.
Yeah. Like, but okay. Cue number one time, the first instance of then she wandered off. She just walked away. Yeah. She was just, Ophelia, I feel like you need one of those leashes. I feel like you need like responsibility buddy. I think you need someone to have their eyes on you because she is like, she just goes. Yeah. Whatever. I now child of the 80s, 90s, like hypervigilant parenting to a certain degree, you know, like stranger danger and all that. She just wanders away and picks up a rock and the adventures begin.
Yeah. She picks up a rock and then she goes to a statue and realizes that this rock can fit into one of the, it's like a missing hole where an eye should be. She puts the rock in there and that apparently brings out an insect.
My favorite character in the entire film.
And she asks the insect, are you a fairy?
And it chitters because it's an insect. It's like, yeah. So sorry for that noise.
That was pretty good. That was a pretty good insect. Hold on to that for your B-roll.
Okay, I will. Yeah. I will. Okay. That's all you're going to hear. The last installment of this podcast, this episode, is going to be like the fourth installment will just be me making that noise.
Right.
I'm not going to do it again though right now.
And then her mother sees her talking to the insect and she says, oh, well, we have to get going. And Ophelia goes along with her. And as they're going back to the car, her mother is saying things like, this is when we meet the captain, you need to call him your father. And I noted in the subtitles that her mother is asking Ophelia to call the captain her father and not to really pay too much mind to it because it's just a word. Like, just say he's your father. And just, that's just a word. And it's like, I understand. And it's kind of like, you know.
I don't recall a single instance in the entire film where she actually calls him father.
I know. But it's still kind of telling about like the way that the mother is with the captain, even at the very beginning. She's like, this is something that we kind of need to just be on our best behavior here. And you just need to do as you're told. Mm. So at the very beginning, there's kind of like this rule and order that has to be enforced. It's kind of not like as strict as we see in the captain later on. But her mom is kind of like, you know, we need to keep up appearances, fake it until you make it.
Yeah. As she's saying it in front of his men, though, I was like, oh, all right. Yeah. We just have to protect his ego at all times.
Right.
And I know how that is because I need my ego protected at all times.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if the soldiers are used to having to do that for him.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think you're right about that. So. Cue introductions with the captain, right?
So then the next scene is everybody arriving at this mill that, for whatever reason, the captain is stationed at and all these men are there. It's kind of gives this compound kind of a feel. And they come out and Ophelia's mother is, the captain insists that she go ahead and sit in the wheelchair because the doctor doesn't want her to exert herself. And she kind of pushes back, which is interesting considering her entire character is just like, even if she does have an opinion, she doesn't necessarily state it all the time unless it's,
she's certainly a submissive character when it comes to the captain.
Yeah.
She has these little subversive moments. The first being, you know, it's just a word. And then later on in the bathtub.
Right.
Wait, that sounded wrong, but we'll get to it. It's just, it's interesting because I totally mistook when he leans in. He asks her to sit in the wheelchair. She's like, no, I'm fine. I can walk perfectly well. Mm-hmm. And he leans in. He's like, do it for me. And then when I first saw it, I was like, well, maybe he does love her because he's insisting that she take care of herself. But upon the second viewing, I was like, oh, nope. He's controlling her body. I wouldn't like that either.
Yeah. And so she does go into the wheelchair. And when Ophelia comes out of the car, she is like holding her books with one hand. Like, it's her right hand. And she kind of like brings out her left hand, even though he's very much like holding out his right hand, which, I mean, you would think she would, you know, switch her books around so she could accommodate.
But she's 11. Yeah. I mean, like, this happens again and again in the film. Like, you're talking about an 11-year-old kid, and you're expecting them to operate as an adult.
And she's also she looks very terrified when she first meets him.
I would be too.
Yeah. And it doesn't help that he, you know, grabs her hand. Like, why are you shaking a hand like that?
Yeah. I wrote it down as the creepy handshake scare meat. Yeah. And then he's like, it's the other hand. And she's just like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
But then, like, there's no follow-up to that. They just go in the house. Oh, she goes and finds a bug.
She finds a bug. And she just drops her books for this bug. And then she just wanders off.
Second time.
Yeah. This is like at this point, we're in the second time. So we have the Ophelia walking away counter for this podcast.
Yeah, man.
Already on number two. But she just runs off and she goes up to this pathway that leads into a very creepy looking maze that has... You pointed out that it was had a
it's got a pan, it's got a fawn head at the top of it, and it's a visual pattern that happens throughout the film. But she just gets to the entrance because she's stopped by our dear, dear loved woman of this film,
Mercedes.
Oh, I do love me a Mercedes.
Yes. And she takes Ophelia back to the mill, and Ophelia repeatedly tells Mercedes that the captain is not her father, and her father was Taylor, who died in a war, and that captain was not Ophelia's father. She, like, repeats.
Yeah.
She's very insistent, like, this man is not my father.
Mercedes eventually is like, you know, I get it.
Yeah.
Except she says it really nice. She's like, it's understood.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And then we see the part of the reason why the captain is here is because there are rebels afoot, and the captain's been stationed out here more than likely to deal with the rebels. This takes place in 1944's Spain, which, like, what was that? I think it was 1936 to 1939, there was a civil war. And after 1939, a fascist regime took place. I think that's what the Wikipedia said about the Spanish Civil War. So I could be wrong. I apologize. I am an ignorant American.
No, that's okay. If you want to learn more, go to Wikipedia yourself or use one of our many fine libraries.
Mm-hmm. Search engine.
Use Bing. Google it on Bing.
Google it on Bing. Go to Bing.com. Type in Google.com.
Just make them mad like that. I think I've literally done that.
Okay, but Mercedes is, so we see the captain marking down areas where they see, where they've seen the rebels, and he says to mark, you know, men here, here, and here. And Mercedes is bringing the captain and his men some provisions, some probably like a snack or lunch or something. Mm-hmm. And she's completely, obviously,
she ain't even side eyeing. She might as well like grabbed his shoulder and looked over it like a curious little bunny.
Excuse me, Captain. I gotta check out what you're doing. Just pushes him aside.
What could my ignorant woman folk be doing looking at your fancy picture map?
Mm-hmm. And then she leaves that area and meets up with...
Wait a minute. She's, yeah, doesn't she head upstairs to where Carmen and Ophelia are settling down with the doctor and...
Right. And so she, the doctor's in there.
Oh, because, sorry, Captain sends her upstairs to go fetch the doctor because he wants to talk to him.
Okay, thank you. So the doctor is with Carmen, Ophelia's mother, and Ophelia, and he's trying to give her just a couple of drops from a vial into some water that's going to help her with her pregnancy.
She's supposed to have it when she goes to bed, so it's certainly some sort of drug.
It was so ominous.
I don't remember.
Was it like a sedative?
Yeah, okay. It was certainly. I wanted to call it like a Oxycontin, like some sort of like opioid, but I'm like, I don't know. It's just an old timey yellow liquid in a bottle with a dropper. It's a lot of presumptions. Maybe it was just some strong chamomile, Naomi. Maybe you can't just decide that kind of thing.
That dropper does become important later on, by the way.
Yeah.
But he goes up there and he's talking about the instructions to both Carmen and Ophelia. And then he packs up his stuff, moves out into the hallway. And that's when he comes across Mercedes, who is trying to talk to him about he hands her a package, mm-hmm, and says, this is the most that I could do. And so there's obviously like,
they're in hushed tones. It's definitely some sort of like secret conversation.
Right. And she informs the doctor that there's a guy there who needs help with his leg. And we don't know anything, but it's very obvious that, like, the fact that she's looking at the captain's map and she's asking the doctor for help with some people, that it's kind of, like, heavily implied that she's helping the rebels.
Well, and then she turns around and sees Ophelia standing in the hallway, and her face pretty much locks in that she's up to something.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dramatic reverb.
Yeah. And Ophelia goes back to her mother, and her mother is like, I'm going to go ahead and take your brother's acting up. Tell him one of your stories. And this is one of, I mean, the whole movie is so good. I really do love this movie, but this is one of my like top five moments because she's like, she's telling her brother, and you see her laying on her mom's stomach, and then you see her brother, or you get like these nice little, like, kind of like a fairy tale being played out. And it's just,
it's visually nice because you cut from her to this, this animation of, I mean, a realistic animation of the baby in the womb. And then it pans as if the womb goes on forever into the story that she's telling about this blue rose on a mountain.
And how, like, men were taught. I think it's interesting. I feel like this story has to be significant. I don't see Del Toro putting anything into his movies that doesn't have something in the way of significance. But this could be just like kind of like a cultural, it could be one of those cultural moments that we're just completely ignorant to. But it's an interesting story about a rose on top of a mountain that's surrounded by thorns. And men are talking about the suffering that it would take to actually get to the rose, but nobody actually goes and attempts it. So nobody picks the rose that would give them eternal life.
Yeah. Well, and Guillermo was, in some summation he was making to somebody about the purpose of the film, he talks about a quote from a saint, something that I don't remember what it do, but a person at war, their cause ends at, when they die, but when a martyr dies, that's when their dreams really go on. It was a really interesting quote, and I should have written it down, but I did not.
Oh, okay. So that's probably the significance of the story.
Well, I was just saying the rose hasn't really fulfilled its purpose until it gets plucked. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what, spoilers, she's the rose that gets plucked.
Coping mechanisms through stories, foreshadowing with roses.
So the doctor goes to Vidal about Carmen's condition as Vidal is fixing this watch that has a broken face, though we don't actually see that at the beginning, but it's very obvious he's fixing a watch, and he's in a room that is in this mill where it has like a bunch of cogs.
It's the mechanism that makes the wheel work in the mill. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's redundant. But what makes me the most mad is that he's wearing those thick freaking black gloves that he was wearing when he grabbed her hand so hard earlier. He's wearing gloves. Look, okay, if I was repairing a fancy watch now, I would wear like latex gloves.
Nylon?
I would wear like hospital gloves to like work on the watch because you wouldn't want your oils or whatever in there. I'm sure that's the reasoning, but he's got these thick gloves on and it doesn't make any sense. And I want him to take the gloves off. He's not even touching the stuff. He's got a little swab.
Oh, yeah. That's all he's really doing. He's just applying oil to the gears.
Just take the gloves off.
Yeah. I mean, he's not even like doing it with the fingers. He's doing it with a Q-tip.
Yeah.
Were Q-tips around back in 1934?
I mean, they were this time.
Apparently. Okay. Maybe in Spain. Maybe not in the U.S.
Maybe it's not that new of a idea to stick a piece of cotton on a stick so that you can poke a thing. No, wait. Don't go there with it. I was just saying as a tool. I mean,
Sorry. My apologies.
That's okay.
No, it's not. No,
it's really good. No. We're on the same page. Okay. But now the doctor is berating him about, like, you made her, well, she's very pregnant. You made her travel all the way out here. And I can't believe, like, why are you?
I wonder what the doctor's history with the captain, which is by the way, Vidal. The captain is Vidal.
Yeah. And I'll keep calling him the captain because I won't remember Vidal.
Okay.
Names are a problem.
We don't know the history with the captain and the doctor. So maybe this is like their first time really interacting with each other.
Well, he questions Mercedes later on, asking like, how do you know him? And she's like, everybody knows him. So I think he probably only met him once he was stationed there. And I don't think he's been stationed very long because, you know, right. He had to have been in town at least nearly 9 months ago.
Yeah. The doctor is kind of probing and he's a little bit more opinionated than you want to be with this captain, because this captain doesn't like his opinion being challenged. Mm-hmm. Like, at one point, the doctor asks, how do you know baby that you're going to have is a boy? And the captain's response is, don't fuck with me.
I only produce X chromosomes. How dare you suppose otherwise?
My personal note is like, someone's just asking him a general question, like, would you like fries with that, sir? And his response is, don't fuck with me. I mean, I don't know a lot of doctors, but with people that I know, there's always kind of this, like, there's this feeling of, like, doctors have this bit of an air about them because they've gone through so many years of medical school.
Oh, yeah. My mom calls them M-deities.
Okay, good, good. So it's not just me. But it's kind of one of those things where the doctor is a little bit arrogant in this exchange with the captain. But the captain is, like, super arrogant.
Yeah. Are you saying their egos bounced off each other and we found out which one was bigger?
Yeah, but the doctor is like not a douchebag. He's got an ego, but he's not a douchebag.
He just seems like a stronger character, especially at the near conclusion of the film. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really see that he's just a person who is like...
He knows
like,
who he is.
Yeah, and I'm not going to not question things because that's not how life should be.
Right.
Yeah, he's got some strong philosophical things going in his favor.
Right.
Let's go to my least favorite scene.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The scene where the captain shows his kind of justice. I put justice in air quotes in my notes.
I heard those air quotes a mile away.
Yeah. Yeah. So two men are brought to the mill for firing off a gun in the middle of the night. They say that they've been hunting rabbits. And then Vidal is brought to them and he starts pulling out stuff from their bag. And like, there's the guy who's actually hunting the rabbits and his son is there. And his son is just like, if my dad said he was hunting rabbits, he's hunting rabbits. And Vidal's like, pulls out this pamphlet that he calls it like red propaganda.
I think it was something like that he uses. It just, it's very obviously like something that he, like individualism over the state, like the, mm-hmm. the name, like the
you word. Being subversive with your reading.
I know. And he takes that out, and then the kid, and the guy's just like, you know, I trust my dad if he was saying he was hunting rabbits. And then the father says, yeah, I was hunting rabbits because I have two girls at home who are sick. And Vidal pulls out.
He's got a bottle in there, and he pulls it, the cork out, and he's smelling it while the guy is talking.
Yeah. And it's hard to say if the captain is annoyed, but because he's
pretty, told the dude to shut up and he didn't stop talking.
That's a good point. And so the
he told the son to shut up. He wanted the dad to talk.
Okay. So, but the son keeps talking. And so he takes the bottle, which the son is still talking. And, the captain takes this bottle and
grabs him by the lapel, like just by the scruff of his shirt.
And he starts stabbing the narrow end of the bottle into the face.
No, it's the blunt end.
It's the blunt end?
Yeah. That's why his face is so smushed. Oh. Like he would have instantly gouged him. Horror movie fan here. He would have like gouged his eyeball out or like broken the bottle initially, but the end of the bottle is thicker and so and flatter, of course, and so like he's just blunt force traumaing his face into like a different shape. And it is, I mean, when I first saw the film, it was so jarring. I mean, just because, I mean, I watch a lot of film, but normally there's a cutaway and your imagination is supposed to be worse. Guillermo was like, oh, hell no, bitches. And he's like, you're gonna watch this nose go from an outie to an innie. And the dad, his reaction is just so perfect because he's just so traumatized. Mm-hmm. He's like, you killed him. You killed him.
Yeah. And you see this. Normally, I think to save on special effects budgets, a movie like this probably wouldn't be showing something like that in progress. If anything, they would show the aftermath of it.
Yeah. Have like a dummy laying on the ground with a smush face, or they'd have, or they'd cut away.
Yeah. Like a bloody bottle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The dad freaks out, gets shot.
Oh, I a minor detail, and I just love it when a minor detail goes so well. Mm-hmm. The captain, who's just bludgeoning this guy, turns with his gun to shoot the dad. He shot him in the chest, and the officer was holding the dad back, and captain pulls the gun. The guy shifts his body really fast, because if you know anything about guns, you can't use, and this public service announcement brought to you by Shocked and Applaud at shockedandapplaud.com. Is that you cannot use a body as a shield. A bullet doesn't care, and it's going to go through both. And so the whatever officer pivots really fast. I'm like, yes, yes, thank you.
Small little details.
It was a beautiful detail, and I think that it's worth noting.
Yeah, and so they continue to go through the bag, and then guess what they find after these two men have died?
They find an entire commune of... not communists. It's rabbits. They find rabbits.
They find two dead rabbits, like small ones, not even big ones.
Because they're in a starving country.
Right. So it's, yeah.
Let's go to something funner. So she's in bed with her mom.
And she, guess who arrives? Guess who arrives? It's the insect.
Yay, I still don't have a name for this bug fairy. I should look it up. I don't know what it is.
Well, how about we call him like bug? He looks like a grasshopper.
Twigsy,
because he looks like a twig.
Yeah.
Okay. So Twigsy comes in, and he's just like, you know, I don't do it very well. All the way onto the bed, and actually, no, she like she hears him come through, mm-hmm. and then she goes to step off of the bed, and then he goes underneath.
Yeah, it skitters across her feet. Mm-hmm. No lie, would jump back in bed too.
Yeah, and so he comes up at the foot of the bed, and she's like, "Oh, you're the fairy from earlier," and comes up closer to her, showing interest, and she pulls out one of her books and says, "This is what a fairy looks like," and it transforms into a fairy.
Yeah, it goes from looking like a stick bug to looking like a stick bug grasshopper hybrid to looking like a little, like, feminine form fairy.
Right, with wings and everything. And,
it's so cute, I could die.
Yeah, and that's when it goes away and she follows it.
Well, now it's got arms and fingers and stuff, so it gestures, it's like,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, and so she leaves. I think this is like the third time she's left.
She wanders away for a third time in a guarded compound, and nobody gives a flying F-a-roo.
Mm-hmm. And this is when we get to the labyrinth, and the fairy is guiding her through the labyrinth all the way down to the center, where there's an opening and a stone staircase that's leading all the way down to the bottom.
Yeah, where there's a intricate pattern carved into the floor, and there's a stone pillar in the middle with carvings on it of people.
Yeah.
Air quotes. Did you hear that? Air quotes. People.
Yeah. And she goes all the way down to the bottom where she meets the fawn.
Okay. So my notes here say, why is she not screaming? Because this thing is easily 8 or 9 feet tall. It's got like this giant broad face and horns. And as much as I believe she read a lot of fantasy, like this thing has like goatee root legs and like it's gorgeous in a way. But yeah, it's terrifying.
If I was a little kid and I saw this thing in the middle of the night while I was far away from anyone who I remotely trusted, I would be terrified. Yeah. Especially since like the way that Doug Jones moves in the costume is just, it's all kind of like, it's like his character hasn't moved in a while and he's still like trying to get the feel of his arms and legs.
It's really the way that Doug Jones, let's just say his name a lot. Oh, if we ever get merchandise, can we just put his face on it?
Yeah.
Because then people would know what his face actually looks like.
I wonder if he would want royalties for that.
No, we'll just draw it so then we have artistic right. It's a tribute thing. It's more, yeah.
Yeah. Doug Jones counter.
Doug Jones.
Do we have anyone who can, I can't draw faces.
Oh, well, no, I got some hookups, like friends. Okay.
Okay, good.
But, so he says to her, and I don't know if you caught this, do you remember her princess name?
Moana.
Ah! Ahead of his time, Giro comes in for the win. It scoops Disney. It scoop him.
I tried to search for the Spanish meaning of Moana just to see if there was any kind of like significance to the name.
Hmm. And are you saying it doesn't mean ocean? Because Moana means ocean. I looked it up.
That's the thing. In Hawaiian, it means ocean. And that's the only results that came up because the movie is like out now. Anyways, but I did think that was funny. I mean, my initial reaction was, you know, I am Moana. You know, the way, yeah.
I am Moana! Okay, back to the creepy movie, not the feel-good one that will...
Should see John's face.
If you can make the person who has to listen to this business for like hours after the fact, if you can get him to giggle, like... That's a big deal to me.
Yeah. So the fawn tells Ophelia that she's actually Princess Moana, daughter to the king of the underworld, and that the king is trying to get her to come back. And they just happen to be at a portal.
The last portal.
Yeah.
But then he assigns her three tasks because, and this is the grossest thing, I think, maybe in this entire film, and we haven't even gotten to the amputation yet, is that they need to make sure her essence is intact.
Yeah, they need to make sure that she is not fully mortal, that she is still able to go to the underworld for undisclosed reasons that never get explained.
If there were weird arbitrary rules to like getting to go to a better place like that, like I know I would mess it up right away. They'd be like, did you pour the creamer in the cup before you poured the coffee? Because you're right out right now.
Right. I would be like, okay, I need to like take some notes. So that way I'm making sure I get every single step. I'd be like, okay, don't go anywhere. I'd run back to the house, leave, get a notebook and a pen and probably a flashlight because it's dark out.
Somewhere he gives her an instruction manual.
That doesn't have anything in it.
I know. It's blank. It's blank. It'll tell her everything she needs to know.
Yeah. Now, I do think it's interesting that it's a blank book, but books are one of Ophelia's favorite things.
I think if it is her own narration, right? Like if this is a coping story, then it makes sense that it wouldn't be something that she could easily access right away because she doesn't know what to do next. She doesn't know what she's coping with next. We're on day one.
Right. And I mean, I guess if books are her favorite thing, then that would be the one thing that she would automatically go to.
Oh, but what did you say about her? Okay.
The first time I saw that, I was like, that guy just gave her a D&D manual and a bag for dice.
It does look exactly like that. All right. So then he disappears and we're done with that scene.
We go back to the captain.
Who's shaving. And can I just say, he does all of these very meticulous things because he knows best and he's got this, he's the top of the heap. He's going to do it better than anybody else. He's shaving in this scene, right? And every time they cut to him doing something really meticulous and just the right way, I want to scream. Like it feels so like, it's not even decadent. It's just so indulgent, maybe. Like, and I'm like a Krispy Kreme away from being a hedonist. For some reason, like, it just makes me mad.
So just one Krispy Kreme away from being a hedonist?
Maybe a handful of donut holes.
Yeah, he's like,
he lives in this part of the mill that has gears. So the backdrop for most of the scenes where he's in his own room are pretty much like he is this clock that he was fixing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a good point.
Yeah. And so it makes sense that he would be like, everything has to be neat and tidy. Everything has to go in a specific way. If plans fall apart, which we kind of see that they do for him, he's not a calm person. He freaks out, but he kind of has this calm stone exterior.
Yes. All of what's wrong is on his insides. Like, mm-hmm. Yep. You're absolutely right.
Right. Oh, and this is the scene where after he shaves.
He shaves his face. Is that the one where he mimics cutting his own throat? Or is that the other one?
I think it's another scene.
There's two times when you see him shaving.
Right. And the first time it's like, oh yeah, everything's okay. But the second time is like kind of right before everything goes to for him. Okay. Oh yeah. So this does. So, Mercedes comes up and
it's a different scene. Like he's sitting at a table in front of a fireplace.
Okay. So, but isn't that the next scene is when?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it goes from him to him.
Okay. So the next scene is Mercedes coming in and picking up.
Like he hands her the rabbits and he's like, yeah. He's like, cook these. And she's like, they're too young. Them's not good eating rabbits. And he's like, make a stew out of them. Oh, by the way.
The coffee is burnt.
Yeah. And he's like, taste it. He stands up and hands her the cup and then does this shoulder sweep. Like from shoulder to like mid arm, he like rubs her arm and I don't know how she didn't scream either. No, my solution to most uncomfortable feelings is to scream, but how she wasn't like physically repulsed.
Well, I think she was, but she's kind of like the captain. She's kind of got this like exterior going on, but everything underneath she's not always showing her emotions. If she does, it's in very subtle ways and it's not around people that she doesn't like trust in some way. Cause he's like trying to be affectionate, but in a really kind of creepy, you're my boss. I don't feel comfortable with this kind of touching kind of way.
Yeah. It's almost like they're both playing chess, but he's like, it's chess because chess needs to be played. And she's like, it's chess because it's life or death for me and the people that I love. But she outies from that room. She doesn't even instruct the chefs in the kitchen. She's just like, cook these. Oh, and he didn't like the coffee. And then one of my favorite lines of the entire film comes out of one of the workers' mouths. There are these old, like, there's these granny types. And one goes, he's such a fussy dandy. I love the term fussy dandy. I know that dandy has been derogatory in the past towards certain people, but it used to mean just a fancy boy who needs a delicate touch. And so, like, a fussy dandy. In my head is like every over the top handkerchief anime character. A dude diva, you would say. Okay.
Yeah. And Mercedes doesn't seem too interested to kind of deal with the gossip because the other servants aren't just talking about the captain. They're also talking about this party that's going to be coming up later in the day and how some people are, eat as much as pigs. And
they could eat two pigs. And there's just laughing. Just camaraderie in the kitchen.
Right. Kind of, you know, showing how the servants, you know, how they interact with the main characters. They're flat characters, but they support the round characters.
Well, yes. Sorry. And there's always going to be between the government, military. Wow. Am I really going to say that sentence? Government military complex that's in charge. And then like the non-military government schleps that the rest of us are.
Right.
You're going to keep being human.
Right. Like imagine for anybody who has worked in like an office setting or in just any kind of a setting where you have a manager over you and that manager isn't necessarily over you all the time and you're just kind of with your coworkers, chances are you're not going to hold back your actual opinions of your manager when it's just your coworkers, not unless you got someone who could rat you out.
Straight up, I have worked in the school districts for the past couple years and can I just say that the break room is like my favorite place to watch people decompress because you're like, oh, that's how they talk about. And then all of the different aspects and probes that come into work in a school, be it administration or the parents or the students or the fellow teachers or all of the components get talked about in the break room. So if you're just quiet long enough, you're going to hear some mad talking.
Right. And Mercedes doesn't seem too interested in interacting with that kind of coworker dynamic. She seems pretty like, you know, everybody else is willing to talk. And Mercedes doesn't seem too interested in actually interacting with that kind of dynamic with her coworkers, so to speak. She seems more interested in just like, I got a job to do, I'm going to do it. And maybe it's because she knows that, like, I mean, she...
If she runs a tight ship, she's going to get in with the captain. Mm-hmm. So if she wants to get what she wants, then she just has to play his game. And that is just like, no right. time to waste, ladies. Cook these rabbits. Let's go. Ha ha ha.
But in a lot of ways, that's kind of what she's doing. She's just not trying to support the captain in any way. She's trying to actively like undermine him later on.
Yeah. Yeah. So. She's not shutting these ladies down, but she's keeping her priorities in front. And that makes sense. Now it's a bath time.
Yeah. And so they draw a bath for Ophelia, and Carmen, her mom, gives her a new dress and shoes, and her mom just absolutely loves this outfit.
She made it by hand.
That's why.
Yeah, she's like, she had promised her a really big present, like a big surprise. And it's this handmade dress that's absolutely gorgeous. People fawn over it, mm-hmm. fawn over it.
And Ophelia goes ahead and takes, you know, a bath, but she just, you know, shuts the doors, and then she pulls out the book and the stones, and she reads what her first task is.
Were you as shocked as I was when you discovered we'd be reviewing Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, The Plotter? Or was my outro about offensive dinner table scenes last week enough of a giveaway? Hey, this is your audio engineer and the fam they call John, Jonathan, thanking you for starting on our wonderful maze of run-throughs and side quest-like conversations as we traverse the dark territories of this Spanish cinema classic. You might have noticed that in the last 40 minutes, you haven't heard one single ad. Until now, because this is an ad. See how cool that transition was? Well, here's your opportunity to thank us back. It turns out, your friends like you, and we could really use a larger audience. Why not subscribe first, then share an episode, tag us, and let us know your favorite part? You can reach us at shockedandapplaud.com, shockedandapplaud@gmail.com, on Twitter at shockedapplaud, Facebook at shockedandapplaud, or please, even if you can only spare $1 per month, search for us on Patreon. We'll even send you a high-quality download of our intro song, My Own Boss Battle, which you can't even find on the internets, because I wrote it, and I'm hypersensitive to rage criticism. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.